is no political idea in the world whose goal isn't to spread. No one engages in politics to fail or be defeated. Politics is an effort to turn ideas into reality. However, the media of normalizing regimes use the term exporting the revolution to refer to a supposed Iranian expansionist project. The irony is that discussions about an Iranian expansionist project have significantly increased over the past 23 years, particularly after the United States, along with its military and allied forces, occupied Afghanistan and then Iraq, following the destruction of both nations and the bombardment of their societies. In other words, at the height of American expansion, hegemony, and occupation in other countries, the media of the normalizing regimes, which were complicit in the occupation, and during the peak of the Israeli push to crush the Palestinian Second Intifada, concluded that the primary threat to our nations was the Iranian expansionist project. The history, however, provides us with a different perspective. For instance, following the success of the Cuban Revolution, its most prominent figure, the Argentine Cuban leader and doctor Ernesto Che Guevara, was dispatched to various countries in Africa and Latin America. Their goal was to support societies rebelling against the governments that are under control. Ironically, Guevara and the Cuban Revolution faced the same accusations that today the media affiliated to the Arab normalizing regimes use against Iran. However, back then, the accusations against Cuba were about exporting the revolution and spreading communism, in contrast to the exporting the revolution and spreading Shiism that Iran is accused of. This historical example demonstrates that the U.S. hegemony, along with its followers and agents, employs the same methods and tools against any party or state that attempts to break the established hegemonic system. On the other hand, we use the Cuban example to highlight that the fight against American hegemony cannot be achieved by stagnating and staying within one's own borders. The reason is simple. The borders one seeks to hide behind are the same ones drawn by the hegemony itself. Choosing to submit behind them will not stop the hegemony from reaching and achieving its goals in that society, just as it happened in Iran over 70 years ago when the CIA intervened in the country. In fact, the CIA and the Israeli Mossad overthrew Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh in a military coup orchestrated in 1953. In fact, the CIA and the Israeli Mossad overthrew Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh in a military coup orchestrated in 1953. In summary, history teaches us that engaging with oppressed peoples around the globe is both a duty and a necessity for any genuine liberation movement. What significance does it hold if the stability and true independence of your country are directly connected to a border issue? Given that Iran is fully aware of the real global contradictions and as a result of consolidating its role in the confrontation with the Western hegemonic system, a significant political competition has emerged between two major projects in the region. The first is the Western hegemonic project. This is the primary driver of all events and the fate of the region, whether through the demarcation of our borders, the definition of our identities, the plundering of our resources, or our annihilation if we choose to resist. More specifically, the Western hegemonic project has been the only dominant actor in the region since the French campaign in Egypt, led by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1798. It solidified its role as the main actor in our countries after World War I and the defeat of the Ottoman Empire. The West interpreted this defeat as our own defeat, and therefore, since then, it has treated us as the vanquished who must pay the price for their failure. In contrast to this hegemonic project, it's natural that a counter-project emerges as a reaction, the project of confrontation with hegemony. For instance, during the 1950s, Nasser's Egypt and the Arab Nationalist Project took on the challenge of confronting Western hegemony in our countries. After Egypt fell into the quagmire of Camp David, David, the forces opposing this hegemony, along with its crown jewel, Israel, faced siege. This ultimately led to the siege, destruction, and occupation of Beirut in 1982. At that time, Iran was deeply involved in the Iran-Iraq War, which former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein acknowledged was a trap set by the United States and the Persian Gulf states to weaken both nations. Nevertheless, Iran's steadfastness during this war and its commitment to the principles of the revolution led to the establishment of the Foundation for a New Initiative aimed at countering Western hegemony over our country. This initiative would later be known as the Axis of Resistance. The core idea of the Axis of Resistance was to unify the efforts of popular armed forces in various conflict zones against Western dominance. The goal was singular and clear: the eradication of the Zionist entity, meaning the liberation of Palestine. The innovative aspect of the Axis of Resistance was the shift from the theoretical slogan of eliminating the Zionist entity to a concrete project, with a serious effort to implement it on the ground. To achieve this goal, the Axis powers focused on two fundamental ideas in the battle. The initial idea was to lead the Palestinian resistance and equip it with all possible capabilities. This aimed to establish a state of ongoing confrontation and wear down Israel within Palestinian territory. At the same time, efforts were made to create a fire belt surrounding Israel, while also generating a pressure cart to attempt to achieve a balance, even if partial, against the endless American and Western support for Israel in the war against the Palestinian people. This is where the competition between the two projects began. While the United States was strengthening its presence in our countries, first through the occupation of Iraq, then with the destruction of Libya and Sudan, and later with the overthrow of Syria, the Axis, amidst all these events, was enhancing its capabilities and presence. This was achieved by bolstering the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, the victory of Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006, and ultimately the resilience of Ansarullah in Yemen. Furthermore, the threat posed by the American Takfiri project in Syria turned into an opportunity to intensify coordination among the Axis powers, seek the opening of a new armed front in the West Bank, and threaten the newly established American bases in Syria. This competition between the two projects erupted with the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and its aftermath. The scale of the explosion and its effects on the region clearly illustrate the strength of both projects, especially in resisting Western hegemony. After the 1973 war, the United States and Israel had clearly eradicated any chance of establishing a balanced regional alliance to counter Israel, until the emergence of the Resistance Axis, its development, and its rise to prominence known as the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Undoubtedly, the training and development of the Axis of Resistance forces was a result of collaborative efforts. See you next week, God willing.
You're maker of my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. Oh,
it's my fault. You may change both my hands, but never my soul. No, never my soul. It's my voice.
Good morning to you all, and thank you for listening to us. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. It's nice to have you with us. We start off this hour's program with Round the World with Reporters. Different reporters from all over the globe tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands. Hadith of the day is coming next. This program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Our radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is The Last Savior. This program discusses the occultation of the Imam of the Age, the promised Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, the culture of waiting, and a lot more.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since launching its military operation in Jenin camp in late January, Israel has allowed 25 Palestinian women to briefly return to the camp. The entry was granted in coordination with the Palestinian liaison. However, three of the women were still denied access despite prior approval.
A soldier stopped us from going in, even though we had coordination. I only wanted to enter the camp, see its streets, its alleys, and my home. I wasn't going in to collect belongings. It's been 6 months since we were displaced. We haven't seen our homes. We used to stand on the edge of the mountain just to catch a glimpse. They forced us out, and we were left with nothing.
Among those who was allowed to enter the camp was Sahar Abu Zaini, who was displaced several times since 2020.
We have lived through many rounds of displacement, but this one is the most painful, both in terms of the days we are enduring and the number of martyrs and the wounded. Also, we carry the weight of what's happening in Gaza, which surpasses even our own suffering. We ask God for strength and compensation for the pain we face.
This isn't just about demolishing buildings. The Israeli regime is trying to reshape life in the camp entirely. The demolished houses represent entire lives and memories that the regime has erased.
The situation in the camp isn't like it used to be at all. All the houses are damaged, destroyed, and affected. My feeling is a mix of joy and sadness. I saw my house for the first time in 6 months. It was heavy when I returned to my house and saw it, even though it was badly affected, but we hope to return to the camp and rebuild it again.
Across the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians continue to face forced displacement and the destruction of their homes. But despite all that, they remain determined to stay on their land.
The occupying Israeli regime is changing the entire life structure of the residents of the Jenin camp by altering not only the physical space, but leaving the inhabitants, who are deeply attached to the camp, with no alternative options to make their lives sustainable. Tibasi, occupied Jenin.
Detonating cords, ammonium nitrate, tritium are among the materials Italy's far-right government has been illegally supplying to the Israeli regime since the start of the Gaza war in early October 2023. This is the outcome of an investigative report by the Altra Economia magazine. The report was presented on Tuesday during a public conference held at a branch premise of the Italian Senate in Rome. Despite the Italian government's denials, the magazine has exposed how the executive led by Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has been increasingly providing Tel Aviv with dual-use materials that can be easily used to build explosive or even develop thermonuclear bombs.
Italy never ever exported detonating cords nor ammonium nitrate to Israel before 2023. One could say these materials are intended for civilian purposes. However, the high quantities of exported ammonium nitrate leads us to think that it is destined for military use. As for tritium, Italy does not even produce it. Rome buys it from Germany. Rome's sale of tritium to Israel has guaranteed revenues from just a few thousand euros in October 2023 to 1.5 million euros in 2024.
During the conference, it was pointed out that these dual-use materials have been shipped to Israel through Italian companies not authorized to trade weapons. Italian magistrates have opened an investigation into a shipment of more than 13 tons of metal components destined for Israel and held at the port of Ravenna on the Adriatic coast. Since the start of the Gaza war, Italian firms have also been selling Israel light weapons, ammunition, and spare parts for M346 trainer aircraft, acting in violation of Italy's constitution and laws.
The outcome of the magazine's report is extremely grave. Magistrates must investigate these circumstances. If our government is violating Italian norms on arms smuggling, Italy would be an accomplice in Israel's Gaza genocide.
By supporting Israel, Italy has chosen to be on the wrong side of history. Rome is completely subjugated. Disregarding international norms will lead the world to a future of wars and insecurity.
Italy is the third largest seller of arms to Israel after the United States and Germany. Over the past months, mass pro-Palestine marches have been held in Rome to denounce what the protesters see as the Italian complicity with the Israeli regime in the Gaza genocide. More and more Italians have finally realized the nefarious role played by Israel and the United States in West Asia. Max Civili, Rome.
A chilling new trend is emerging in the Israeli military's genocidal campaign in Gaza. The systematic targeting of civilian cafes, lounges, and local gathering spots. Over the past few weeks, airstrikes have increasingly hit these densely populated civilian areas during peak hours, with cafes and social hubs becoming a recurring target. The Gaza Ministry of Health confirmed that dozens have been killed in at least six separate attacks on cafes and social venues in the past 10 days alone. The most prominent was when the Israeli warplanes dropped a powerful 5-ton MK-82 bomb on the Al-Baqa cafe, teeming with families, students, journalists and artists, which resulted in at least 30 fatalities.
It was a war crime. This place was full of people fleeing the scorching heat of the tent and the lack of electricity, and came to do their work, to study and to connect with their friends. The surrounding was also full of displaced families and tents. This was a war crime that can never be justified.
This pattern of attacks appears to be a deliberate tactic to maximize civilian casualties and the psychological devastation among the people who cling to any thread of a normal life.
Beyond the physical destruction, the deliberate targeting of cafes and lounges strikes at the heart of Gaza's social and cultural life. In a region where power outages, displacement and trauma are the realities of every day, at Ibrahim Gaza City.
As the U.S.-Israeli attempted genocide in Gaza reaches 21 months, Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Washington amid a major protest against his arrival at the White House. It was widely reported that a ceasefire was going to be announced.
This is such a crime on such magnitude that we'll be talking for generations about this starvation and shooting. It's hard to comprehend, to be honest. It's like a nightmare that never ends. So this is an opportunity, Mr. Trump. This is your chance. Make the difference.
In what many called a twisted contradiction, no ceasefire was announced, but Netanyahu did say he had formally nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. The continued refusal of a ceasefire left many saying that Tel Aviv seeks nothing less than the complete eradication of Gaza and its people, and that only Washington could turn off the war machine.
I would like to see the U.S. first and foremost stop all arms to Israel, and they need to flood Gaza with aid. People are starving to death. People have no water. Babies have no formula. It's absolutely immoral and disgusting, and we need to get them aid as soon as possible. And it's completely possible. It's all in the hands of President Trump.
Poll after poll continues to show that support for Israel has plunged to once unthinkable levels, especially among Democrats and Americans under 50 years old.
I don't think they've changed enough. So I don't understand how we could be still supporting Israel. Last week we sent them a little over $500 million for new weapons. I don't understand how we could be supporting Israel at all. So I wouldn't consider whatever amount of change has been to be enough. So it doesn't impress me.
As a result of their disastrous 12-day war on Iran, the two leaders are now forced to pivot from promises of regional domination and Iranian collapse to some sort of a new strategy. What appears certain to many are their likely goals: continued U.S. imperialism, an end to organized opposition towards Zionism, thwarting the democratic self-determination of the average Arab, and all at whatever the cost to Palestinian, Arab, and Iranian lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Daily Twitter and Fars displacement. This is the reality for Palestinians in the northern Jordan Valley. Following the 1967 occupation, the Israeli regime built settlements there due to its proximity with the Jordanian border, fertile land, and abundance of water availability. The first settlement, Makoza, was built in 1968, followed by the Alon Plan that led to the creation of seven new settlements. These settlements are located along the Jordanian border and on the eastern mountain slopes overlooking the Jordan Valley.
The suffering inflicted by settlers is akin to death. They forcibly displaced us, employing a brutal strategy of compelling us to obey their orders. If we refuse, they resort to stealing and killing livestock under the full protection of the army and using weapons. Furthermore, they seized land and continuously threatened the Palestinian population, creating an environment of fear and terror. In addition, they inflict physical and psychological harm by demolishing homes and depriving Palestinians of their most basic human rights.
Settler violence in the northern Jordan Valley is a daily occurrence, often with the support of Israeli soldiers. This includes the forced displacement of Palestinian farmers and herders, confiscation of their property, and physical assaults. The aim is to displace the local population and seize their land for settlements. Palestinians are denied access to their land, while settlers act with impunity, controlling resources and land as if they are the rightful owners.
The tragedy of the Jordan Valley lies in the statements of Israeli ministers and the policy of occupying regime, which is no longer hidden. We know what is happening in the Jordan Valley, and it is Israel's colonial and expansionist plan in order to expel Palestinians and replace them with settlers, demolish Palestinian homes, and tighten the noose on them, depriving them of the basics of life.
Israeli forces are systematically oppressing Palestinians, including shepherds and farmers, by confiscating essential resources like tractors and water tanks, as well as seizing their livestock. These items are being auctioned or subject to exorbitant fines, making it difficult for Palestinians to reclaim their property.
Israeli settler gangs, under the protection of the occupying forces, keep attacking Palestinians in the northern Jordan Valley on a daily basis. The regime also continues the seizure of new areas in the West Bank through its policy of forced displacement. Tiba Asi, occupied West Bank.
Oh.
A wave of gasps, chants, and tears swept through the crowd as leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, walked into the Ashura night ceremony, his first public appearance since the Israeli aggression. This surprise appearance came after a 12-day period of silence. His physical absence triggered widespread speculations, including reports about potential health concerns.
The Moharram ceremonies are taking place without the presence of the leader.
The mourning ceremonies took place in his absence, and we cannot find him in any of the pictures or videos.
There is much speculation that he has left Tehran.
Saturday's event marked not just a return, but also a defining move. Now his presence not only addresses these concerns, but also serves to galvanize national unity against external threats.
In under 12 hours, our leader replaced all the martyred commanders and issued a video statement vowing revenge against the enemy. They struck us in the morning, and we retaliated that same evening. Within days, the balance shifted, and they came begging for a ceasefire. It was our leader's resilience that led us to victory.
The leader did not speak, yet he made a defining move, asking eulogist Mahmoud Karimi to perform the patriotic anthem, Iran, Iran. The performance electrified the mourners, linking faith, nationalism, and resistance.
Hey, Iran, Iran. دور از دامان پاکت دست دیگران بدگوهران
While chants echoed and tears flowed, the quiet presence of Ayatollah Khamenei spoke volumes, with his presence redefining the narrative. Not just for Iran's enemies, but for the entire world, the message is loud and clear. The leader is triumphantly in command. Gizumi Shahmali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. As we are in the sad days of Muharram, my heartfelt condolences to you and to the Imam of the time for the sad events that happened even after Ashura in these days. Welcome back to our program. Today's light comes from Imam Ali alayhi salam, the voice of reason and justice in the early Muslim world. His words are more than advice, they are guidance for survival in confusing times. He says, look carefully at the family of your prophet, stay close to their path, follow in their footsteps. They will never lead you away from guidance, nor will they return you to destruction. If they pause, you pause. If they rise, rise with them. Don't go ahead of them, you'll go astray. Don't fall behind them, you'll be destroyed. So let's unpack this together. Who are the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam? They are the family of the Holy Prophet, those purified by the Quran itself. Indeed, Allah desires to remove all impurity from you, O people of the house, and purify you completely. They lived closest to the Prophet, knew his heart, understood his mission, and embodied his values, not just by knowledge, by life and action. Imam Ali alayhi salam, Sayyida Fatima, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam here is saying, when the world is noisy, when leaders disappoint, when ideologies fight, stay close to the ones who never left the right, left the light, and left the right. So this isn't just history, it's a living model. Following Ahlul Bayt means seeking truth like Fatima Zahra, living justice like Ali alayhi salam. Embodying patience like Imam Hassan alayhi salam, standing with dignity like Imam Hussein alayhi salam, holding on to wisdom like Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, carrying knowledge with compassion like Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and more. They didn't just teach Islam, they lived it through crisis, power, oppression, and love, everything. Today, our youth are exposed to endless influences, trends, ideologies, philosophies. Who can guide us in this storm? Imam alayhi salam says, look at the Ahlul Bayt. Look to the Ahlul Bayt. You will not be misled. A 2021 study on identity formation in youth, published in the Journal of Religious Psychology, found that having a living role model, especially someone who embodies both faith and struggle, significantly increases a teen's resilience against peer pressure and moral confusion. That's what Ahlul Bayt offer. Not abstract sermons, but real human models of faith, pain, love, and sacrifice. So let's follow Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam closely as best as we can, and we inshallah will find the path in every aspect of our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavit Ahwai. Today's featured guest is Andrew Peter Napolitano, otherwise known as Judge Napolitano. He's an American retired jurist and syndicated columnist, a news analyst, a legal scholar, and best-selling author as well, whose work appears in numerous publications like The Washington Post. Now, his X account reads, "Judging Freedom, Hard-Hitting Legal Political News, Defending Individual Freedoms, Respecting the Constitution." Well, that's what we're going to take a look at with him. He joins us now. Judge Napolitano, welcome to Unscripted.
Oh, Kabe, my friend, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The pleasure is all ours here at the program, and I'm going to ask you about this flag or banner on your X account, Hard-Hitting Legal Political News, from a man who knows and respects the Constitution and the importance of defending individual freedoms. I'm wondering why you brought that in. Either that obviously ranks very high with you, or you felt maybe a need to highlight it, since maybe parts of it, again, this is my just observation, perhaps, that some parts of it are failing, perhaps, American people.
The Constitution is failing the American people terribly. It is not followed by any of the three branches of the government. Under the Constitution, only the Congress can impose taxes. We've allowed the president to impose a tax. Under the Constitution, no one can be confined by the government without being brought before a judge for a hearing. The president has denied them hearings. Under the Constitution, only Congress can declare war. Oh my goodness, the Congress hasn't declared war in the U.S. since December 8th, 1941. We fought dozens of wars since then. So the Constitution is regularly disregarded by all three branches of government. Presidents take power from the Congress. Congress looks the other way. The courts let them do it. The court system, of which I was once a part, Kabe, as you know, was intended to be the restraint on extra constitutional behavior, but it often defers to the other two branches, the president and the Congress, and lets them get away with it. My recent column, which comes out tomorrow about the government stealing property, concludes with the lamentable statement that the Constitution as an instrument of restraint has been a dismal failure. We pay lip service to it, but the government really rarely complies with it.
Well, when you talk about the Constitution that way, it sounds like it's taking a beating from right, center, and left. I don't mean in terms of the political parties, just in general, right? So doesn't that impact Americans?
Well, yes.
I mean, it impacts Americans to the point where they become disenchanted, don't they?
Yes. The argument that I have made, and many of the guests on my show have, is that we don't really have two political parties in the Congress. We have one big government party, which is controlled by the military-industrial complex, controlled by an insidious organization called AIPAC, with which you are probably familiar, which is a foreign lobbying group that lobbies in behalf of the government of Israel, but doesn't have to comply with any of the requirements that other foreign lobbying groups do. And the military-industrial complex assures extraordinary Defense Department budgets. The new budget will be more than $1 trillion a year. That's more than the next 10 countries, including Russia, which has a better army, and China, which has a better navy. That's more than the next 10 countries combined, but the members of Congress are corrupted by the military-industrial complex. They're also corrupted by the donations to their campaigns by the Zionist organizations, which caused them to embrace a genocidal maniac like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as if he were Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln. So the Congress is totally, totally corrupted by the influence of money in politics.
Very well. Let's take a look at one of the examples, perhaps, that I can name, of how the Constitution, maybe in one form or another, is, I don't want to say violated, but not taken to its word. And there was a clip from X that you put on your account that where Senator Maggie Hassan asked, "What is habeas corpus?" Mm-hmm. And Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said it's the constitutional right that the president has to remove people from this country, of which she responded that that is not the definition of habeas corpus. Is that the type of violation of Constitution, perhaps, we're talking about? Lawmakers and their interpretation?
Yes, Kabe, but it's worse than that because it's gross ignorance on the part of the chief officer of the federal government in charge of the deportations, she doesn't even understand that everybody must be given a hearing before being deported. That's guaranteed by the Constitution. She totally misunderstood what habeas corpus is. Granted, it's a Latin phrase, but it's been around since 1215 in Magna Carta, and then was used again in the Constitution when it was written in 1789. It is the right of every person, not American citizen, but every person, whether citizen or not, who's confined by the government, whether it's for spitting on the sidewalk or murder or illegal entry into the United States, whatever it is, every person confined by the government has the right to be brought before a judge and have the government lay out the evidence against the person and justify their confinement. If this right weren't there, then the government could arrest without trial anybody that it wanted. Now, the fact that she doesn't understand this is extremely lamentable. This Department of Homeland Security, which is not authorized by the Constitution, which was hastily cobbled together in the administration of George Bush and Dick Cheney right after the tragedy of 9/11, has 165,000 police officials that she controls. They don't look like cops. They wear khaki pants and black shirts, and when they arrest you, they wear masks. This is decidedly un-American, but this is the small army that Kristi Noem commands. For her not to understand what the basic laws are is reprehensible. Make it even worse, she has about 500 lawyers who work for her, any one of whom could tell her what this means.
Well, that sounds like she's put the tools in place, but I'm curious about the ones that you described in terms of the attire that they wear. Why do they wear that? I know that some of them have been out, for example, arresting some of the voices of pro-Palestinians, voices from students at different universities, and they've targeted them. Does that fit into this? I mean, is that part of the way that this administration wants to deport people from the U.S.
Well,
in addition to the immigrants?
The short answer to your question is yes. The longer answer to your question is this non-police attire goes back to 2001. I don't know why they don't dress like police officers. Look, the FBI, which is also not authorized by the Constitution, they wear business suits like they dress like you and I are now, so they don't dress like police either. But they also don't go about putting masks on and arresting college students because of what they say. The Department of Homeland Security has been doing that. None of this is constitutional. And the fact that they wear khaki pants and black shirts and masks is just pour salt on the wound. It just makes it even worse. But nobody can answer the question about why they're attired this way. The president can't answer it, and the Secretary of Homeland Security can't answer it. It's sometimes a little creepy when you're walking down the street and you see a couple of dozen of them walking towards you. You say, well, what are they doing here? NYPD, New York Police Department, protects me. I know them when I see them. I know the cops in my neighborhood. I don't know these guys. What are they doing here? So you just sort of hold your breath and pass them.
Looking at one of the points you made about the U.S. defense budget, we call it the military budget. I mean, $1 trillion is a lot. Doesn't sound like that has obviously been reduced in any sense of the word, but rather slowly and surely increased to the level and to the numbers that we're looking at now. This attitude of the U.S. or approach by the U.S. to want to spend that much money translates into many different forms. One of them that I want to ask you about is how they feel like they have to police the world. I know this has been asked before, but tell us the different ways how that translates into the 700 or 750, 60 military, posts or centers that they have around the world, and how that actually affects the foreign policy of the respective countries and what kind of control that exerts on the governments there.
Well, you put your finger on it. I mean, to fund, at one point it was 903. Nobody really knows what the number is. That's the highest number I saw. But it's at least 800 or 900 military facilities around the world that the Defense Department pays for. To make this even worse, the Defense Department has failed the last 8 audits that it is conducted. It is required to have itself audited by outside auditors. All 8, the past 8 years in a row, it has failed, meaning hundreds of billions, with a B, dollars, unaccounted for. Donald Trump has repeatedly said he doesn't want us to be the world's policemen. We're not going to tell others how to live. That the George W. Bush, and this goes back to Woodrow Wilson, but the George W. Bush attitude of we're going to force Western democracy on people as to whom that type of government is alien is no longer the policy of the federal government. However, he says one thing and does another. He still wants to fund all these military operations. We're still in countries that have asked us to leave, and we refuse to leave. Surrounding you now are about 100,000 American troops in about 25 or 30 different facilities. Most Americans don't even know that. What are they doing there? Iran doesn't pose a threat to the national security of the United States. Why do we have all these troops aimed at Iran? I don't think Donald Trump could answer that question if it were put to him.
Well, let's take a look at one of the branches of this whole defense operation. In some sense of the word, I'm describing the Israeli regime and the Prime Minister Netanyahu. He obviously is conducting this genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. That's how we describe this war. What do you think about what and how he is conducting this genocidal war? Because, you know, you've covered that in your program. I mean, really, it's right beyond words what's happening there. And let me ask you this, because I'd like to ask you what you asked in one of your programs. You said, do you think the Americans understand what is going on in the Gaza Strip? I mean, how attached or detached are Americans now, or are they more informed than before?
I think Americans are slowly beginning to understand what goes on in the Gaza Strip. It is the most horrific slaughter of innocent human beings, genocidal slaughter since World War II. It has transformed the Israeli government into the Nazi-like behavior, which they profess to condemn. And nobody seems to be willing to lift a finger to stop it. This week, some of the leaders of European countries, Prime Minister Starmer of Great Britain, President Macron of France, have suggested that they will enter into an embargo and stop trading with Israel. My God, it's too little and too late. We don't even know how many people have been slaughtered. The Lancet, the British medical journal, says it's over 200,000. The Palestinian authorities themselves say that they've conducted funerals for over 55,000. A former member of the Knesset joins with two members of the government, whose last names are Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and openly call for the murder of Palestinian babies by starvation. It's absolutely mind-boggling, the horrific crimes that are being perpetrated by Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, and it's being funded by the United States taxpayer. Joe Biden was derisively called Genocide Joe, and it really rattled him. Didn't change his policies. Donald Trump should have a similar moniker, a similar nickname, because the genocide is just as bad, if not worse now, than it was 6 months ago, and Trump continues to fund it. When the United States Congress authorizes military supplies, whether to Israel or to Ukraine, I think you probably know this, but so your viewers know it, it is subject to the discretion of the president. So even though all these billions have been authorized, he doesn't have to spend it. Stated differently, Donald Trump could stop the slaughter in Gaza in 24 hours with a phone call. He could also stop the war in Ukraine in about 2 weeks with a phone call. He has not made either of those calls. Rather, the American taxpayer continues to fund, in Ukraine, a dastardly losing war, in Gaza, the most horrific genocide of the modern era.
Okay, why do you think he hasn't made that call to Netanyahu to end the war, which we understand he actually has made some motions towards that? We're going to get about the situation in Ukraine in a second. But as you said, with a phone call, he could end this Gaza genocide. Why do you think he's not doing that?
I think he is culturally and financially, not ideologically, he doesn't have an ideology. He is culturally and financially wedded to the donor class. This is AIPAC, American Israeli Political Action Committee. These are wealthy American Jews and non-Jews who are Zionists, who contributed huge amounts of money. One famous one by Mrs. Adelson was a check for $100 million to Trump's campaign, and who contribute financially to the campaigns of about three-quarters to four-fifths of all sitting members of Congress. That train of cash is one that he does not want to disrupt. Now, having said that, there have been a lot of stories in the press lately about how he's sick and tired of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He believes that Netanyahu is humiliating him and playing him like a fiddle, which is an American insult.
Right.
But he doesn't seem to change his policies. He may dislike Netanyahu personally. I don't know if the man is likable or not. He's a horrible human being. But he doesn't seem to change the policies because of his deference to this donor class that has strategically distributed money. They don't march in the streets, Kabe. They don't take full-page ads in newspapers. They have person-to-person financial relationships with all the important people in the government. I'm not saying they're bribing these people. I'm saying they have contributed so heavily to these people's campaigns that the members of Congress want the gravy train to come in. They also fear antagonizing this group. Recently, this group sponsored Democratic candidates in primary elections and spent about $25 million on two elections. That's unheard of in a primary where you normally spend a fraction of that, but they were willing to spend that kind of money to rid the House of Representatives of two Democrats who had the temerity to stand on the floor of the House and criticize Israel.
You're talking about the two as being part of the squad, perhaps, and the $100 million that AIPAC has set aside?
One was named Jamal Bowman, and the other was named Cori Bush. In Bowman's case, he represented the poorest district in the United States of America in the South Bronx, and they managed to spend $13 million to defeat him. That's an extraordinary amount of money in a very small and poor area. In the case of Cori Bush, I believe Corey was from Missouri, and they spent about $10 or $12 million to defeat her. You know, it's really absurd. Not only does the Israeli regime want to prevent the press from seeing what's going on in Gaza, we only know what's going on because the Palestinian people use their mobile devices when there's an internet. They not only want to suppress the press from reporting what's going on, they want to suppress Americans from expressing their free speech. They want to stop members of Congress from criticizing the Israeli regime. And in the case of former Congressman Bowman and former Congresswoman Bush, they succeeded.
Well, Judge Napolitano, one of the things that really is shocking, aside from the gruesome pictures, videos coming out of the Gaza Strip, which is pretty much broadcast in real time, I'm sure you've heard that before, is how you have the Israeli regime officials coming out with some statements that just really truly become shocking. This one coming from Moshe Feiglin, a former MK Israeli parliamentarian. He said, "Not a single Gaza child should remain in the Gaza Strip. Every child in Gaza is our enemy. Child that you are giving milk to in the Gaza Strip will in 15 years rape your daughters and conquer our children." Does that speak of a truth, or does that speak of how they want to forcibly take over the Gaza Strip and displace the Palestinians?
It speaks to the Netanyahu regime. It speaks to an apartheid government, and it speaks to the silence of the West. It's utterly reprehensible that anybody could say anything like that, and very few people would raise a voice against it. As I was mentioning earlier, when Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed the Congress a few if you'll permit this little aside, Kabe. His speech was 56 minutes long. He was interrupted 58 times with standing ovations. The longest and loudest standing ovation was when he condemned pro-Palestine voices. He stood where Lincoln and Roosevelt and Reagan stood, in the very same spot, and condemned the First Amendment, condemned free speech, and the Congress gave him a standing ovation. That's what we have here. In Israel, we have mowing the lawn. They have all kinds of euphemisms, but they want to use starvation as a weapon of war. Tom Fletcher, who's the UN High Commissioner of Humanitarian Rights, you're probably familiar with him, reported 2 days ago that 14,000 Gazan babies have 48 hours to live, or they will die of malnutrition. Has anything been